all the very best. And the whole company, the whole country of Germany, I know is rooting for you. But all of us here wish you all the best. Thank you. That's Peter, Peter Wagner, his father and his mother and sister. They work for us in Germany. So really, congratulations on being a parent of an Olympian. Very hard work. Yes.
So on behalf of your family, first of all, I'd like to really thank all of you for coming here today. It is a very special occasion for us. Special because Maharaji has come. Special because all of you have come. And special because we are just, this is the first few days of a new house that we've got in London. We feel blessed that Maharaji, our family guru, has come here today. It's a very auspicious occasion for us. By way of background, for almost the first 20 years of his life, Maharaj did not know what was India or anything about Hinduism or any scriptures. He was born and brought up in a Jewish family in Chicago. And then he had a calling, and that calling I didn't realize till I read his book, which is there on the table, and any of you who are interested, please take it with you. I can promise you that's a very, very engrossing story. And what when he just had a calling that he had to find something which was his soul wanted to do that. And then he traveled without any money, literally by virtually land and sea from Chicago, landed up in India. And it is another story that he went through life-threatening experiences, but every time came out stronger. We've been fortunate that he's been guiding us for several years, our whole family. I can only say, and you will realize when you interact with him, that he only gives love to everybody. He is totally unassuming, always smiling, always generous with his time, whosoever it is. I'm not going to stand too much between him and you. Maharaj will speak for about 40 minutes, and then he will take your questions. He's going to speak on values are invaluable. So I will give Radhanath Swami to you.
Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Prachariye Nirvishesha Suravani Aschatyate Satariye Vanshapalpadrugyascha Kripa-sindhu-vyadeva-cha Patithanam-bhavani-vyadeva Krishna Devyo Namo Namo. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasati Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
I am very grateful to be with all of you. Special gratitude to Swati and Jane and Peter. This wonderful family, their mother, and all the babies. It's the nature of this family, whatever they have, we want to share with. And they do it in such an artistic, such a thoughtful way. They just move into this house, so they wanted to invite many close friends, associates, in a way that pleases everyone, in a way that receives God's blessings. And their culture is we receive God's blessings by pleasing people, by giving gifts. As you see, they always have special gifts that they give whenever there's an occasion. The gift they're giving to me is the opportunity to meet all of you. Could everyone hear me?
Yes, sir.
Hello? To speak on the subject of a gift that I once received. A gift that I will never forget. A gift that, in a special way, changed my life. Can you hear me now? I don't have the gift of a loud voice. Sometimes very, very sacred truths are revealed to us in very common, everyday ways. May I tell you about this gift? An incredible gift that was loved on an 8-hour bus ride by some very simple, poor villagers. They came to the room I live in an ashram in Mumbai. About a dozen of these villagers came into my room. They were so excited to present to me this gift. It was contained in a big burlap bag. And they took out from that burlap bag another burlap bag. It was tied on the top. And said that this is a gift that has been given or sent to you by Tarabai, but she's too sick to come to bring it herself. As soon as I heard the name Tarabai, my heart softened. And tears came to my eyes. Then they opened the knot and dumped the gift on the floor. Some dust came, got in my eyes. I was anticipating so much to find out what this could be. They as they placed it on the floor, all the villagers, they were really poor. Many of them had smallpox scars on their faces. The women, they had very, very soiled, kind of tattered saris, big, heavy nose rings. The men were wearing baggy clothes and soiled turbans. Most of them had little or no teeth. If they did, they were mostly very blind. Very simple villagers. I knew them well. Some of them were my students. And I knew the hardships of their lives. In their particular village, these farmers were suffering years of drought, where practically nothing grew, and they had no other means of livelihood. So they were just working like slaves in different places, somehow or other to survive. They came with this gift. They looked down. They looked at me. They were so anxious to see if I would be pleased by it. In fact, they were so excited. If they were offering me pure diamonds, it couldn't have been more valuable to them. Now I looked down, I thought back about some years before when I went to visit their village. From Mumbai, with a group of some of our devotees from the ashram, we went by jeep in a couple different cars. And to get to their village, off the main roads were miles and miles of earth and roads and potholes, and we were jerking up and down and up and down. And finally, we reached their village, and there was several dozen of the villagers who were there to greet us at the outskirts. They were singing songs and playing drums and cymbals, and they were so happy they were dancing. Because I was told it's so rare that any visitor ever came to that village. And so it was the first time an American Swami ever came to their village. I especially wanted to meet Tarabai. And as I came out of the jeep, I was remembering the first time I ever met her. It was years before. Tarabai came to Mumbai with her son. We have an orphanage that we've been overseeing for quite a few years. She came to ask if we would accept her son in the orphanage. She didn't speak a word of English, but someone was translating for us. Someone told me a little about her life. What they said was that Tarabai, who was about 50 years old, but she looked like she was about 70 years old. Very weathered, wrinkled skin. Very beaten by the elements. She was a widow. Her husband died, leaving her with three tiny children and a little piece of land that was parched, dry by drought and by the burning sun, and no means of livelihood. And she struggled. She wanted the best for her children, but she was uneducated. I don't think she ever went to a day of school. I was told that in order to somehow or other maintain her children, because nothing grew, she had to get a job where she carried on her head cement about 1 kilometer from sunrise to sunset. She would carry it to a place where there was some work being done, and then she'd come back that kilometer with rocks on a tray on her head. Her frail body, like a slave, worked. And the pay was practically nothing more than some very cheap, crude wheat grain to feed her children for a day or so. She wanted her son to have a better life. We gladly accepted him. And I'll never forget how painful it was for her to part with him. He was only 10 years old. And I never saw anybody so skinny in my life. His name was Gyandev. Literally, and we have some people here who know him, his thighs were about as thin as my wrist. And I'm quite small. She embraced him and wept because she had to leave him. But she saw no other way for his future. Little Gyandev, he was so gracious, so grateful, so enthusiastic about everything. And I remember, as she was leaving, Tarabai told the principal of our orphanage, make sure that he does chores and he works. He shouldn't think that he's a beggar or he's just getting charity. He should understand the value of work, the value of earning what he has, and he should be grateful to God. And then she left. And little Gyandev, 10-year-old boy, he wanted so bad to learn English so he could talk to me. In my little room with a straw mat, mud walls, in the middle of Bombay, every time he would learn a sentence in English, he would run upstairs and very blissfully say the sentence for me to make me happy. And I would usually try to coach him, to teach him how to say it properly, because he never said it properly. And he was just always eager to serve, always eager to do anything for everybody. It was beautiful. Such a value he was brought up with. These were some of the thoughts in my heart as I was coming out of the gym. And I started walking down the road. And they asked me, would you like to go to Tarabai's house? She doesn't know you're even coming. I said, please. As we were walking, it was just a dirt path. I saw on both sides, there were just clay, straw, mud huts, some crumbling bricks. And the land, it was so parched dry, there was deep cracks. And every few places I saw some very withered crops struggling against fate to grow. And I was thinking, these people would have such a celebration if they could get one good rain. Here in London, sometimes you take rain for granted. The world is like that. What is precious for someone else is a disturbance for another person. When I reached Tarabai's house, it was just one room, about 15 feet by 15 feet. The walls were clay, the floor was clay, and there was a straw roof. Inside the house, there was no furniture. There was just some pots for cooking, a little clay box kind of built where you could put some twigs that she would go out and collect to cook with. And there was a trunk with some clothes in it for everybody. What fascinated me is the house was not clean. It was meticulously immaculate. Every single piece of clothes was perfectly folded. Every rag for cleaning was perfectly clean and folded. It was spotless. She would every day, in the village, almost all the wells were dry. She would have to walk sometimes a kilometer or two just to carry on her head water to bring back. She'd use it for her cooking. She'd use it to water whatever little crop she tried to grow. She used it to clean her house. And she put a fresh layer of a certain type of local mud to make the house shine. She had beautiful, colorful designs on the floor and in front of the house to make it really artistic, and she would draw them every day. I was thinking, she took such pride in being a mother, even through her struggles, and I praised her for it. And she said, no. She said, this is Krishna's house. Krishna's our name for God. She said, this is Krishna's house. And I love to clean it. I love to take care of it. And this is Krishna's children. And I love to do everything for them. One of the people I brought very discreetly offered Tarabai some money. And she very politely but very firmly refused it. She said, I don't want my children to think that we're beggars. I don't want my children to grow up depending on charity. I want them to value and be grateful for what they have. And she said in the Marathi language that the greatest wealth that I can give them as a mother is values. I'm remembering words of William Shakespeare. Here in England, Shakespeare wrote, if you lose wealth, you lose nothing. If you lose health, you lose something. If you lose your values or character, you lose everything. And he wrote that human nature is such that we very much are eager to get praise that will destroy us, but not at all inclined to receive criticism that may save us. This is how she raised her children. So I sat down, and soon about 10 villagers, 12 villagers, 15 villagers, they crowded in that little one-room hut, and they asked me to tell a story. I wasn't expecting that. So I was thinking, what story should I tell? It was a very hot day. And the sun was shining through a little rounded clay hole in the wall that served as a window. And Tarabai, she made a fan out of dry leaves and started fanning me with it. So that reminded me of a story. May I tell you the story I told these villagers? It's a story from the Srimad Bhagavatam. Just before Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita, the great scripture of India, Krishna, who we believe is the one Lord of all religions, of all living beings, who descended on this earth about 5,000 years ago, visited a place called Mithila. And we have a person from Mithila here, Sanath Priyaji, and also Anil Agarwal, who live just close to Mithila. Mithila is a small village, a very holy place in Nepal, just above the border of the Indian state of Bihar. And back in 1971, I lived there for some time. And I remember in those days, it was such a simple place. They didn't have cars or trucks. They would transport cargo on the back of gigantic male elephants that had curved ivory tusks. And the horns were the bells that were clanging, big bells, on the necks of the elephants. It was a beautiful time in my life. But long before that, during the time of Krishna, he came to Mithila. When he reached the border, everyone came to greet him, especially two people. One was a very simple Brahmin, very simple man. His name was Shrutadeva. And the other was the king, the emperor of the whole province. His name was Bahuvaspa. And both of them, with great eagerness and devotion, they invited Krishna to come to their homes. Now in our life, we all face this. Sometimes to please one person, you displease somebody else because we're limited. But Krishna doesn't have to worry about that. In order to please both of them, he expanded himself into two forms. And one went to the royal palace of the king, and one went to the simple hut of Shrutadeva, which was probably something like Tarabai's little hut. And Shrutadeva gave Krishna everything he could. He had no furniture. He gave him a little straw mat to sit on. For food, he went out and begged, he had some rice, he gave it to Krishna. To entertain Krishna, he danced and whirled around the little cloth. And he sang beautiful songs just to make Krishna happy. Meanwhile, in the palace, Bahuvaspa offered Krishna a golden throne, the finest foods cooked by the finest cooks on golden and silver plates. He fanned him with silver-handled chamra fans. And he had acrobats, professional musicians, and entertainers giving pleasure to Krishna in every way. And according to Srimad Bhagavatam, it describes how Krishna was absolutely equally happy with both of them. Because Krishna doesn't see what we offer. God sees the intent, the purpose in which it's offered. In Bhagavad Gita, there's a beautiful verse, Patram Putram, what is it? Amitoyam Yome Bhakta Prayachchiti. That even if one offers a leaf of fruit or a little water with devotion, I'm completely satisfied. Whether we offer a beautiful golden throne in a magnificent palace, or whether we offer a little clay cup of water in a straw hut, Krishna, or God, is bhavagrahi. He accepts our love. And I remember at that time, I told them that my mother taught me this same principle when I was a little boy. Sometimes she was offered a beautiful jeweled necklace. And sometimes, when it was her birthday, I would forget to get her anything, but I really wanted to make her happy. So I'd go out into the backyard and steal a rose from her garden. give it to her. And I remember every time, whatever was offered, she would cry in gratitude. And she would say, "It's the thought that counts." She said, "It's not the thing, it's the love in which the thing is given that is all important. Things cannot bring happiness to the heart," she told me. "Only love can do that." She was so happy with the jeweled necklace because it was offered with love, and she was so happy with my little flower from her garden because it was offered with love. After telling this story to them, I saw Tarabai had tears in her eyes. Someone was translating for me, verse, line after line. And then we went to another hut and we had dinner. I was remembering these things. And I was remembering how, as years passed, while I was sitting in my room, waiting to see what this gift would be, I was remembering how little Gyande, he really wasn't a very skilled person, but he just tried so hard. He became the leader of the whole orphanage. Even though he wasn't the youngest, everyone looked up to him. It's like, he was all the other children's guru, because he just had so much gratitude, so much character, and so much affection. He was always so eager to do everything and anything for everyone. And he was so grateful for whatever he had. There's a saying that real wealth is not how much we have. Real wealth comes from the fulfillment of how much we appreciate what we do have and how much we're grateful. That's wealth of the heart. Whether it's a lot or whether it's not so much, we could all be happy. Gyandev, he was first in his class in all, in every grade of school. And as he grew older, he got scholarships to college. The dust cleared, and I looked down to see what this precious gift, a gift that symbolized these people's life, their struggle, and their love. May I tell you what the gift was? I saw on the floor hundreds of shells covered with dirt, each one with a protruding tail on it. It was a pile of freshly picked, crude peanuts. And I thought, what do these peanuts represent? Why are these people so enthusiastic about giving me dirty peanuts? Tarabai, she probably carried on her head hundreds and hundreds of buckets of water put on the ground to grow these peanuts. And it was the first thing in several years that grew out of her soil. And the dirt on the peanuts were the sacred soil in which her first harvest grew from. It meant so much to them. They were so happy to see me so happy. I had to cry. I remembered when I was a little boy, I don't know how you would say things here in England, but when something's worth practically nothing in America, we say, it's peanuts. Do you use that phrase here? You know, they're paying me peanuts for what I do. Peanuts are kind of symbolic of something very useless. Although for some reason, peanuts have always been one of my favorite foods. And I remember my mother. What is real wealth? It's the love. And how this was offered with such love. Farmers, they went back very happy. And for the next weeks, any guest who came to my room, simple people, people of low-income areas would come to see me, middle-class people, very, very wealthy people. Whoever came, I would give them these peanuts. I didn't clean them either. As it is, I gave him those dirty little peanuts. I thought it would be like Swamiji, but it's not. Because Swamiji's are a little bit respected, people wouldn't ask, why are you giving me peanuts? They would just look at me like, thank you. And I would say, eat them, eat them. And they were raw. You know what a raw, dirty peanut tastes like? It's unsalted. It's right out of the ground. And I didn't explain to them anything of what they symbolized. But I believed in my heart the energy contained in those peanuts of the sacrifice and the love of Tarabai and those villagers would affect them, would purify. And every day I would eat a couple of those peanuts. And my experience when I eat them, my tongue moved aside. And I tasted them with my heart. And they were absolutely delicious and nutritious. This story is about values. Gyandev, late today, he is a professor of mathematics after getting his master's degree at one of the leading universities in Mumbai. And he's providing profusely for his mother, helping his brothers get an education. And he's very happy. In fact, I gave a talk at Gyandev's marriage. I was there at his spiritual initiation, and I was given the privilege of naming his first little child. A boy who was raised with the example of his mother's values and integrity. And she became so proud of Gyandev. Not because of what he gave her in wealth, but because of the dignity in which he lived. Bhakti is about the development of this gratitude. Bhakti means the path of devotion. And we believe from the teachings, there's a beautiful verse from Srimad Bhagavatam. Savai pungsan paro dharma yato bhaktir hokshache ahoitiki aprati hata yagatma suhasana. That the most fundamental need of every living being is to love and to be loved. Because that experience is the only experience that can actually give fulfillment to the heart. Things that give some fulfillment to the physical senses and the mind, but they cannot touch the heart. And our great scriptures and our great saints teach us, and this is a universal principle of all the great spiritual paths, that the origin of that tendency to love comes from the Atma, or the soul's natural inherent love for God. And when that love is awakened within our heart, it naturally extends to respect, compassion, and affection for all living beings. The Gita tells us, Aham Bija Pratapita, that the Supreme Absolute, the Lord, is the father and mother of all living beings. In the Holy Bible, Lord Jesus explained, and it's explained the same way in the Old Testament by the Jews, that the first and great commandment is to love God with all your heart, all your mind, and all your soul. And what is the natural consequence of loving God with your heart, mind, and soul? You will love your neighbor as yourself. And everyone is our neighbor. Whether they are black or white or red or yellow or brown, whether they're from the east or from the west, whether they're rich or poor, whether they're Christians or Jews or Muslims or Hindus or Jains or Parsis or Sikhs, or whether they're agnostics or whether they're atheists, or whether they don't know what they are, or according to the Gita, whether they're humans or elephants or dogs or cats or cows, wherever there's life, there is a sacred expansion of God, a sacred child of God. And to love God means to recognize and honor and feel compassion. And the natural expression of that love is seva, the desire to serve. Perhaps the greatest value in the military, in most companies, colleges, one of the greatest values, especially in family, is selfless service. Service that is offered without desire for selfish gain. Whether it be profit, prestige, selfless service, service that's actually offered from the heart to please God and to please others. In our tradition, we chant beautiful mantras or names of God to awaken this love within our hearts. This, in my own travels and in my own life, you know, Jane was explaining about this book that I wrote. If any of you want to grace this little book with your eyes, I would be very honored. But it talks about how I studied Judaism and Christianity, and I studied Buddhism, and I studied Islam, and I studied so many different branches of Hinduism. I was really, to be honest with you, I was from the 1960s. That's when I was a teenager in America. And it was a time to challenge everything. Because there was so much hypocrisy. There was so much conflict. There was a type of civil war between generations in my country. I marched with Martin Luther King's people. I demonstrated with civil rights leaders and with demonstrations against the Vietnam War. Sometimes I was tear gassed, sometimes I was beaten. But I was looking for something I could really believe in. I heard the words of Gandhi, "Be the change you want to be in the world. Be the change you want to see in the world." And I came to the conclusion that that means there has to be an inner change in my heart. And I felt it had to be spiritual, but there was a problem. I was hated by so many people of religions because of the minority religion I was born into. And I saw prejudices from the people of my own religion toward others. And I was seeing in histories some of the worst atrocities of hatred, violence, vengeance in the name of God. And I came to the conclusion in my own little life, I was only a teenager, either I have to totally reject the concept of religion because there is so much hypocrisy and hatred and division caused, or I have to dive deep to see if there's really something beautiful and sacred and unifying at the essence of all of them. And in my journey, I believed so strongly, I was so convinced that that essence was something, the most beautiful thing in all of creation. The awakening of love. The awakening of compassion. My guru, Srila Prabhupada, he would say, that philosophy and rituals have little or no value without character. And I remember himself, he came to America from India with nothing on a cargo ship. And he struggled in the Bowery, which was a ghetto, just trying to give people the gift of a universal understanding of how to love God and be a gentle, compassionate instrument of that love. And somehow, after great struggle, some people who were favorable toward him got him a little beaten-down storefront room in the Lower East Side of New York. And they only gave him enough for the first month rent. He didn't know where he would get money for the second month. And he started sharing this. And the previous tenants of that little storefront, they were running a trinket shop, a shop where they just sold all kinds of very cheap little gifts. And the name of it was on a sign, still over the storefront. It said, "Matchless Gifts." And one day, when Prabhupada had some students, one of them was going to take that down and put a new sign. And Srila Prabhupada looked at it and smiled. And he said, "What we're giving? Bhakti. Devotion to God. Teaching people this essential universal principle of character and love for God and compassion to others." He said, "This is a matchless gift. So leave the sign up." And that matchless gift is within all of us. It's our greatest potential.
Questions or any comments anybody would have, then Maharaji would be very happy to answer them.
Do you have anything? Okay. You can speak up.
Yeah.
If somebody wanted to start, how he start, how he begins, what you hear as he comes from the very clean background, what after hearing from you, if somebody has to start, how he start to make his life beautiful, as you said, with the service, with love, with devotion, how to start, or where to start? The real transformation is a transformation of values. It's a transformation of transforming arrogance into humility, greed into generosity, vengeance into forgiveness, envy into compassion, hatred into love, and ultimately anxiety into fulfillment and happiness. When we associate with people who actually teach with their words and with their lives these values, and we really aspire, we learn to aspire and to value these values, that this is greatness. My Gurudev used to say to the Prabhupada that a person's greatness is in our ability to tolerate even provoking difficult situations and maintain our dignity and integrity. You see, whoever we are, whatever we have, storms come in life. In the Bible it is said, if you build your house on shifting sand, then the storm will make it crumble. But if you build your house on a strong foundation, no storm can tear it down. That foundation gives us integrity, values, where we don't compromise our values, our ideals, even when there's temptations. How much more I can get if I compromise. Or fear of how much I can lose if I don't. Those values are sacred. And the value of really connecting with the foundation of inner fulfillment is what can make us strong and bring us real happiness and make and give others real happiness in our family and the world. That foundation is so important. I was talking yesterday to a group of people about how if a fish is swimming on the surface of the river, a hawk could just plunge in, grab it with its claws, take it out. And the hawk of fate is flying over all of us. It could come down any time. But if the fish is swimming deep, the hawk cannot reach it. Anxiety, frustration, these things are only on the superficial mental platform. They only really affect us if there's not something deep that we're experiencing within ourselves, in our values, and ultimately in our love for God, which is the deepest fulfillment. So the first beginning is to actually understand that this is really what I want. And then whether we are doctors or lawyers or industrialists or teachers or farmers or students or swamis, whatever our occupation, whatever our status in society may be, when we integrate these values as the foundation of whatever we do, And we seek out the company of people who inspire that, who give us that strength. And then we start giving some time, some valuable time every day to cultivate that foundation within us. Just like this house of Ajay and Swati and Anand and Anandini and Peter. It's a beautiful home. Many of us are coming and seeing the wonderful, wonderful artistic artwork and the beautiful carved moldings and the furniture and the woodwork and the architecture. But how many of us are thinking, what a fantastic foundation this house has? You don't see it. But the foundation has been holding up this house for how long?
100 years.
100 years. We can only renovate what's here because the foundation is holding it up. Foundation's all important. Sometimes we're so concerned with the things we can see, we forget that the foundation of our life is our connection to God. Our values and our integrity, our compassion. That's what gives us fulfillment. That's the depth we all have. If we're like a little fish and we dive deep inside, then we can pass through the storms of life with such integrity and be instruments of greatness. So these are some of... To hear about these things, to be with people who inspire these ideas, that's the beginning. And then to put some time aside to actually cultivate. In our tradition, we chant these beautiful mantras. It's a meditation on God's names to actually awaken those inner experiences. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. Yeah, sure. Where are your mic? Here.
It's absolutely fascinating, you know, the way you drive your point home. And it's a simplistic way, and it goes right to your heart. But I have a tricky question. What made you embrace Hinduism from Judaism?
I don't see it that way. Others do. For me, it was never going here from there. Because I was really trying to seek the essence. And I saw such rivalry and competition and terrorism and everything else that's always been going on. It's nothing new among religions. I wanted to find that universal experience. And I believed it was there. And I believed there was one God. The sun, sometimes it shines here in London. When it rises in London and you actually get to see it, even if you don't, you call it the sun. When it rises in Mexico, they call it soul. When it rises in India, they call Surya. It's the same sun. It's not an Indian sun. It's not a Spanish sun. And even though there was a saying, the sun never sets in the British Empire, it's not a British sun either. The sun is everyone's sun. So, you know, each religion has their name of God and their approach to God. Same God. And somehow or other in my travels, I came in contact with a place called Vrindavan, where the spontaneity and the genuineness of love of God was so deeply meaningful to me. It touched me. And the explanation of the Hindu scriptures for me was so inclusive. It was concepts that for me included all other genuine religions and religious philosophies. And when I met my beloved Guru Srila Prabhupada, he was such a model of such deep humility, compassion, and intoxication of love that I just just wanted to participate in what he was doing and learn from him. So in my, if we love God, in my understanding, we're really Hindus, and we're really Christians, and we're really Jews, and we're really Muslims. Because we're lovers of God. The concept of Krishna as the all-beautiful, all-sweet, all-attractive Lord just enchanted my heart. Actually, I'll tell you one little story. It's written about in this book. When I was 19 years old, I began my journey. I went with a friend from Chicago that I grew up with from 10 years old. We went on a summer trip to Europe just to understand how other countries beyond my own, which I never had been out before, how they view society and values and God and how they live. I want to expand the horizons of life. And eventually we were living in, actually I was living here in London for some time, in 1970. Eventually we were living in a cave on the Isle of Crete in Greece, and then I had a calling to India. So I left my friend. We had no money. I started hitchhiking to India. From London to the border of India took me 6 months. And when I finally arrived, you know, hitchhiking through Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, it was not easy in those days. Actually, last year I spoke at SOAS College, University of London, and they asked me to speak about my journey, and I kind of did. And then afterward, this one very brilliant young girl, about 22, she came up to me, and she said, "I'm really fascinated by your story, because I am president of the All-UK Hitchhikers Association." "And you hitchhiked all the way from London to India? I want to take a group of hitchhikers on the same route as you." And she said, "Can you give me some guidance?" So when people ask you for guidance, you're kind of responsible for what you say. So I said, "Oh, no prayer." I said, "My dear friend, please, take your group and hitchhike to Heathrow Airport. And then take the airplane to your room. You can't do it these days." But interestingly, when I finally got to the border of India, I had gotten so many diseases. I was almost killed several times. I was covered with dust. I was emaciated because I usually didn't get food. But I had I felt I was being called by God, by destiny, to India. When I came to the border, I was rejected. Because I had no money. I had 26 cents in 5 currencies. They said, "We have enough beggars in India. Go back." I couldn't go back. I was in a no man's land between India and Pakistan. I only had a 1 entry visa to Pakistan. I couldn't get back there either. And I pleaded and I cried, and they put guns in my face and said, "Go back, you are rejected." And after 6 hours of pleading and crying and praying, finally there was a change in guards and they let me in. After I cried before this new officer, who was a Sikh gentleman, and I promise someday I'll do good for your country if you give me a chance. That was in 1970. And last year, 41 years later, I was invited to meet the President of India, Pranab Pratibha Patil. And I was being escorted by the top security officials past one border post or one post after another. And as I was going through the presidential palace, these beautiful pillars and Bhagavad Gita on the ceiling and gold leaf, I was thinking how things have changed. And when I reached the president's office, she was with folded hands and a basket of fresh fruits. She greeted me. And she asked me the same question. Why, of all countries in the world, did you choose to live in India? And why, of all religions in the world, are you following this Hindu? And I gave her the same answer. When I told my father this story, he's 88 years old. When I told my father this story, he was so happy. He said, "This is a story of rags to riches." And I said, "Actually, I still kind of wear rags." And I haven't had a bank account or signed a check since 1969. I have nothing in my name, so I don't have riches, and I don't. But then I thought a little deeper about it. Thinking that even one grain of a speck of love of God and compassion to others is the greatest treasure in all the creation. And when we can find that in ourselves and we can share that, then everything else we do in life has such deep meaning. I hope that answers your question. I don't even remember what you asked me.
Yeah, Dr. Agarwal.
Please.
Thank you, Maharaj. And you mentioned about the values. We acquire these values when we observe, we watch, we read, we take guidance from the seniors and our teachers. And having acquired these values, build the foundation, we start living this material world. And with all these pressures, the attractions and these distractions, there's a constant pressure to shift the foundation and shift these values. And this pressure is on all of us while living in this world. And it sometimes really gets hard to resist this pressure. You partly answered this question, but could you guide us as to how to remain firm once we've tried to follow this path?
We have to swim deeper in that hawk of temptation, that hawk of fear, and that hawk always there trying to grab us. If our fulfillment in life is on a very shallow level, we're affected by every wave and every storm and every raindrop and every hawk and every crow. We require the deep lives. And that means taking some time every day, same answer really, to associate with people who inspire that and actually have a spiritual practice. Through prayer, through chanting God's names, through seva, through selfless service, give time to actually cultivate that in our hearts. So there's a deep fulfillment where we actually are not affected by all of these diversions, distractions. Because in this world today, whoever we are, we will be bombarded by the weapons of mass distraction. But if we're focused, then we have a deeper fulfillment where we don't need to be concerned. We know what we have to do, and we do it right. Like Tarabai taught her little son Gandhi. You see, the spiritual values and the spiritual devotional practices that really sustained him gave him such a higher purpose. He studied harder than anyone. For him to get a good grade in school, he probably had to study 2 or 3 times harder than anybody else. But he did. For him to get scholarships when he was illiterate when he came, these spiritual values do not make us complacent. Rather, they give us a higher, more enthusiastic purpose in our determination, in our professionalism, in everything. But it's coming from that depth, from that deep foundational place. If we agree to this principle in our own hearts, then we will strive to cultivate it and live by it. Does that answer your question?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Can I share something with the Lord? Yes. The Lord of thanks. Just last week, I came to this house, and we were having a redone. I couldn't see an inch of anything. It was covered with dust. There were carpenters, plumbers. And I said, actually, we're making a mistake. We've called all these important people, and this isn't going to get done. So he said, Krishna will look after it. Krishna will do it. Don't worry. And I said, Krishna will have to work very hard to get this house in order for all these important friends of mine to come. And next morning, I was like very disheartened. But in the morning when I came, suddenly, magically, you know, everything started to appear. So I think Krishna worked very hard for this week to get this done. And I wanted to thank Maharaji for this wonderful talk that he gave us and for blessing us. The first time he's staying at our house in Mumbai, and we don't stay. He doesn't come to our house to stay, but he always comes anyway. But this time, we are really honored. I'd also like to thank the temple here of Watford and the whole crew here. It's all by voluntary effort. And they have also cooked the meal this evening from the temple. And this week is Janmashtami. The coming 10 days is Janmashtami, where they make food for how many thousand people?
60,000
people. All by voluntary effort. And it's wonderful. Like, they did help me out on the first day. Thank you so much to the Dharma. The whole crew was all young people who were college training, and I'm really grateful for that. I'm also very grateful to Bendit, who took time out from the Olympic movement, but from his team on the one holiday that he had, he could have just partied with all the friends that I see that are talking about young people. But I think the Olympics requires a very special devotion, very special hard work, like the one you mentioned. And to be there is very, very special. Thank you for coming. Thank you for spending the evening with us. We wish you again all the best of luck for your event tomorrow. I'd like to thank everybody for coming. Please, dinner is served on the right side.
I'd like to say a very big thank you, Swamiji, for an incredibly inspirational talk. A huge sense of serenity, which I didn't have when I went there. And I'm sure we'd all like to say a very big thank you to Swati Anajay for hosting this wonderful hug. And I wish you many, many happiness. Yeah. Thank you so much for asking all of us to join us.
For the house to have a look. You're most welcome. My son designed his part of the house for the first time. And like every mother with great trepidation, I said, what on earth is he choosing? But I said, if he makes a mistake, it's fine. So let him do it. But actually, do walk into his multicolored house, as he calls it. So please join us for dinner.